The second case for oral argument this morning is in the matter of the estate of Mary Louise Pringle, deceased. For the appellants and interested persons, Judith Maxwell and Thomas Pringle, is Mr. Eric Picker, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellee, Mr. Ronald Pringle, is Mr. Brian Utzman, an attorney also from Rapid City. Mr. Picker, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please court, for the counsel. My name is Eric Picard, and I do represent the appellants in this matter, Judith Maxwell and Thomas Pringle. This is an appeal of the judgment and order and the findings of fact and conclusions of law entered by the Honorable A.P. Fuller of the Seventh Judicial Circuit in the matter entitled State of Mary Louise Pringle, deceased. Appellants are the children of Mary Pringle. This matter arose out of a dispute as to the validity of three real property deeds and whether the appellee Ronald Pringle, also a son of Mary Pringle, exerted undue influence over Mary in regard to obtaining the same. Now, these deeds, if valid, would convey to Ronald and his son certain real property that, but for these deeds, would have remained in the deceased grantor's estate and been subject to the operation of her will. This will divided the deceased estate equally between Ronald, Thomas, and Judith. Now, in the trial court's findings of fact and conclusions of law, the trial court found that these three deeds were indeed valid conveyances and that they were not the product of undue influence. The trial court failed to rule in regard to whether Ronald breached any fiduciary duty owed to Mary by reason of a power of attorney. Appellants appealed these decisions to the court, and I have 3 points to make to this court today. Number one, we submit that the trial court erred in finding that Ronald rebutted the presumption of undue influence. Number two, the trial court erred in finding that appellants failed to prove, by preponderance of the evidence, the elements of undue influence. And three, that the trial court failed to rule on the issue of breach of fiduciary duty. There was no finding in that, in the findings of fact and conclusion of law. Now, the facts of this matter have been thoroughly briefed by the parties. However, I do wish to review with this court several dates that I find to be of particular importance to our argument. The first being, on August 23rd, 2000, Mary Pringle executes a durable power of attorney, which named Ronald Pringle as her agent. On September 12th, 2000, about 3 weeks later, Ronald Pringle contacts attorney Michael Unke with questions regarding avoiding probate, putting farmland into joint tenancy, and how this might affect an existing will. 2 days later, on September 14th, 2000, Mary Pringle contacts attorney Unke and requests that he prepare a deed transferring the farmland that she owns into joint tenancy with her and Ronald Pringle. 5 days later, Mary executes a warranty deed to that effect, which effectively transferred farmland valued at over $1 million in a joint tenancy with her and Ronald Pringle, the consideration for which was love and affection. Those dates...
What about the will? Was there a will that was prepared around that time?
There was a will that was prepared around that time. That was prior to these deeds being effectuated and being executed.
And she executes a will giving property equally to her children, and then shortly afterwards, within...
That is correct, Justice Koenkamp. There was a will executed which devised her property equally between three of her children, Judy, Thomas, and Ronald. After that is signed and witnessed, then we have the transfers of this farm. Now, obviously, these transfers go against her wishes of her will. Placing this property in a joint tenancy with her and Ronald effectively removes it from the estate, and therefore it can only be divided equally between the three children, as his prior will had allowed for. It's also important to note that a will that was drafted while her husband was still alive showed the same estate planning, where there was the property was divided equally among these three children. Now, early on in the trial court ruled, as a matter of law, that there was a presumption that Ronald exerted undue influence upon Mary in obtaining these deeds. And the trial court ruled that the burden of proof, therefore, shifted to Ronald to show that he took no unfair advantage of Mary based on his power of attorney. That meant that Ronald had the burden of going forward with the evidence. And the trial court made this ruling based on the very power of attorney that was signed August 23rd, 2000. trial court found that this had created a fiduciary duty. And as we know, as a matter of law, such a power of attorney does indeed create a confidential relationship and a fiduciary duty. And that's what the trial court made its ruling based on, as far as the presumption. The trial court also found that Ronald had indeed benefited from these land transfers, and that's obvious. He obtained all this property that was in joint tenancy with right of survivorship with him and Mary. Now, so far at this point, the trial court's absolutely correct. Based on established South Dakota case law, such as Davies versus Toms, In re Estate of Unke, Estate of Dubendorfer, cases of that nature. The trial court has not made any error. However, it appears as though the trial court failed to review the evidence, as is directed in Walsh versus Shoulders. The trial court in his ruling stated that he couldn't find proof. He was looking for proof, and he looked at the testimony of Judy Pringle, or Judy Maxwell, and he looked at the testimony of Thomas Pringle, saying he's looking for proof. And he says he couldn't find any proof. But as this court has decided in Walsh versus Shoulders, there is seldom direct proof of undue influence, since it is not usually exercised out in the open. It is therefore usually solely through inferences drawn from the surrounding facts and circumstances that a court arrives at the conclusion that undue influence existed. So there isn't necessarily ever going to be direct, out-in-the-open proof. You need to look at all the circumstances and draw inferences from these circumstances. This court provided further instruction in Black versus Gardner, where it held that a presumption of undue influence arising from a confidential relationship can be rebutted by evidence indicating that the beneficiary took no unfair advantage of his dominant position. In that same case, and perhaps more importantly, this court found that evidence sufficient to rebut the presumption of undue influence requires more than the fact that competent and disinterested advice was given or that the gifts were voluntary. So that case sets out the burden that Ronald had moving forward with the evidence. He had to show more than disinterested advice, and he had to show more that the gifts were given voluntarily.
What did he have to show?
Well, he did provide evidence from attorney Michael Unke. He took testimony from Mr. Unke, as well as his deposition was admitted into evidence. What Ronald tried to show through attorney Unke was that she had testamentary capacity. At least that's how I interpret it. Mr. Unke did have concerns. If you look at the timeline I presented, as far as the dates when certain things went into effect, 2 days after he talks to Ronald Pringle about avoiding probate, placing land in a joint tenancy, and how that might affect a will, he gets a call from Mary. And so this did cause him concern, and he was suspicious. And in fact, he admitted that he thought there might be undue influence. And because of those concerns, he recorded the conversation that he had with Mary, and a transcript was made, and that was admitted into evidence. Unfortunately, as I stated previously, it appears he was more concerned with her testamentary capacity and not whether or not there is undue influence. And that's evidenced by the fact that he doesn't ask specifically, are you being unduly influenced in creating this deed? He doesn't follow up with questions of that nature, and he doesn't ask how many times Ronald had spoken to her about it. Now, these are questions that I feel would be very important to ask if you're trying to determine whether or not a person is being unduly influenced, particularly given suspicious circumstances and dates at issue.
How do you factor in this, if it is a fact, the situation with the mother being estranged from the other two?
Well, it is our position that Ronald was directly responsible for that estrangement. And there's evidence to that. Etta Mae Kleiman, who was the personal nurse of Mary for a number of years, this woman, who, for no compensation other than gas money, which was only occasionally paid, tended to Mary's wounds. She did such mundane things as clipping her toenails. She cared for her. She cooked for her. She got her groceries. This woman, perhaps Mary's closest friend, testified at court that Mary had told her that it was Ronald based on her experiences, it was Ronald that drove the wedge between Mary and her other two children.
Her opinion.
It was her opinion, yes. And she backed that up with testimony to the effect that she was also intimidated by Ronald. In fact, after her deposition, she testified that Ronald followed her to her home, despite her home being in Custer and Ronald living nowhere near the area. And she testified that she was scared and intimidated by him. And she also testified that's kind of his M.O. He was an individual who had an air about him that she testified that was intimidating and caused people to be fearful of him.
But wasn't there testimony, too, that the daughter hadn't talked to her mother in 5 years?
That just goes to show, Your Honor, how effective Ronald was in driving a wedge between mother and daughter.
So he convinced the daughter not to call her mother or contact her mother?
No, there was testimony, Justice Hornikamp, that Judy did try to contact her mother and that she would not return phone calls or anything like that. And at some point, Judy just gave up. She was also intimidated by Ronald. She testified to that as well. She was afraid of what he might do. And I think that goes to show that Ronald did a good job. And the trial court appears to have rewarded him for that.
Let's go back to the rebutting presumption issue. You know, to rebut the presumption, the contestants ultimately carry the ultimate burden of proof. And the rebutting presumption is very slight, just enough from which a trier of fact could possibly conclude in that favor. Now, in this case, you've got Ron, who testifies, basically, that he didn't exercise undue influence. Isn't that enough to shift the presumption?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Justice Sinter. In fact, I was having problems with the burden and how it shifted until I read your concurring opinion in Dubendorfer. The fact that Ronald brought up testimony on his own behalf, you look back at Black versus Gardner. Evidence to rebut the presumption of undue influence required more than the fact that competent, disinterested advice was given or that the guests were voluntary. That's all he offered.
That's Unke. But Ron also testified.
And that's his testimony. I'm sorry.
Why can't the court rely on his testimony about whether or not he exercised undue influence?
The court can't rely on his testimony because the trial court in his ruling stated that he reviewed all the testimony of any party that stood to gain by this in that light, and that being Ronald, Thomas, and Judy. He made that finding. In fact, that was part of his findings of fact and conclusions of law specifically, that he looked at their evidence, at their testimony in that light. So therefore, that tends to show that his testimony was slighted, was tainted by the fact that he stood very much to gain. The property at issue here is worth about $1.3 million. Forgive me if that's not entirely accurate, but it's in that range. And all he gave for that was his love and consideration, allegedly. So there's a lot of property here, and of course he's going to testify.
Wouldn't be the first kid in South Dakota to inherit the farm, would it?
What's that?
Wouldn't be the first child in South Dakota to inherit the family farm, would it?
No, it would not, Your Honor, but importantly, Mary and her husband had wills in place that divided the property equally among 3 children. That was her estate planning. That was what she wanted to do. In fact, she testified. She told Anna Mae Kleiman, her friend, confident nurse, who she confided in, that that's what she wanted. She wanted the property to be divided between her 3 children.
And on the other hand, she told Attorney Unke very specifically that she understood that it was going to all go to Roth.
That's a very important point, Justice Sinter, and there's case law that I feel is important for the court to consider in that regard. In Davies versus Toms again, in this case, the court found that the grantor's positive reassurance to the lawyer upon the lawyer's inquiry as to whether or not she knew what she was doing and that she knew what she wanted to do, and furthermore, that she had the right to do it, is entirely consistent with and conceivably supports the contention that the grantor's attitude of mind was due to the coercion of the beneficiary. This is exactly what we have here. Look at the transcript of Mary's conversation with Attorney Unke. She knew what she wanted to do. That's the way I have to have it. That's the way I want it. This goes to show that this is proof of coercion. This is proof of undue influence.
But what we're doing is we're bringing up one example and you're knocking it out with another one. That's what we have trial judges for. They decide those credibility questions. Are you trying to retry the case up here?
We're not. We're trying to show that the trial judge failed to consider very important evidence in this matter. In his ruling, he stated that he went back and reviewed the testimony of Thomas and Judy. All right, and he says he was looking for proof, and he couldn't find any. Well, where's the reference to Joel and Gloria Pine Where's the reference to Deputy Smith? And where's the reference to Adam A. Klein? These are all individuals that had nothing to gain by this. They were completely disinterested parties. And yet every single one of them testified that Mary relied on Ronald entirely. She was very dependent upon him. She relied on his opinion for almost everything and wouldn't make a decision without consulting with him.
How could she do that if he was living in Bridgewater and she was living in Hill City?
That's a very good question, Justice Stoberson. And
usually when you have these undue influence cases, the elderly person is living with the person exerting the undue influence or next door, or they have some manner of exerting that influence. This is obviously by long distance, to say the least.
It is by long distance, but Ronald testified that he had numerous phone calls with Mary Pringle, 14 to 15,000, which broke down about 7 to 10 a day. He's calling her constantly, several times a day. And that would definitely make up for the distance if he's speaking with her daily. That would take care of that particular issue.
You know, the conversation that we're having back and forth with all the members of the court this morning makes me think that really you're arguing that this is a clearly erroneous case rather than an error on presumptions and shifting in the semantics.
That is entirely accurate, Justice Center. It is our position that the trial court was clearly erroneous in his decision and findings of fact and conclusions of law regarding whether or not Ronald met the presumption of undue influence. We also feel that he was clearly erroneous in determining that the appellants failed to establish that Murray was susceptible to undue influence, which is the first element of the four.
Doesn't that take us right back to the Chief Justice's question? The trial court heard all this conflicting evidence. He made a decision, and I mean, you well know we don't lightly reverse those.
Absolutely. I think it's important to look at the trial court's ruling, his oral ruling, regarding what he considered as evidence. He found that Mary told Adam A. Kleiman what Mary wanted Adam A. to hear. And I think that is clear error if you look at her testimony. Here's a woman who, for nothing out of love, cared for this woman daily, took her out of harm's way when there was a fire in the area. This woman had very problematic foot issues, and she dressed her wounds. She took care of her kind of like her children should have. And for that testimony to be disregarded, I think is clearly erroneous. And he doesn't say it's any reasoning for that. He also doesn't cite to any of the testimony. He states he's looking for proof. He said, I'm looking for proof. I find none. And I looked at Tom's testimony, and I look at Judy's testimony. But he fails to reference the testimony of Joel and Gloria Pine, the disinterested witness. Deputy Jeremy Smith, who came in and testified at the trial. He doesn't reference any testimony from him. He doesn't reference any testimony from Ron Johnson, another individual that testified as to statements that Ron had made to him that were suspicious and kind of intended to prove the undue influence elements. Also, Michelle, she testified at trial. Another disinterested witness, a friend of Mary. It seems to me as though the trial court ignored all this testimony and wanted to focus on the testimony of three individuals whom he said he didn't want to really listen to because they had a pecuniary interest in this matter. And I think that's clearly erroneous, and that's why we're here today. I want to touch on my second point of error, that being the four elements of undue influence. In his findings, the trial court essentially relied only on the first element, that being whether or not Mary was susceptible to undue influence.
Well, it ends there if she's not.
That's true. That's true. And I feel as though the court relied too much on this testimony of Mary's strong will. And it's important because there's a case law directly on point on that. Nazilski versus Vinerine. In that case, this court found that even though an individual may have a strong will, that does not lessen that person's susceptibility to someone who is imposing their will upon them. Just because you're a strong-willed individual is not the end-all of whether or not that person is susceptible to undue influence. The trial court essentially found that there was an opportunity to exert undue influence, which was the second element of the four, and then the other two elements were not really considered. I believe we addressed those in our brief, and perhaps on rebuttal I'd like to touch on those more if they're brought up. But the main point of error in the second contention regarding the susceptibility is the trial court placed far too much emphasis on Mary's strong will and didn't look at all the other factors. And again, failed to really listen to the important testimony from Joel and Gloria Pine, who both stated Mary relied on Ronald for everything. She was very susceptible to his influence. Etta Mae Kleinman said the same thing. They all testified that she was very susceptible to what Ron said and what Ron wanted, Ron got.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Utzman, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you. Good morning. Brian Utzman. I'm representing the son of Mary Louise Pringle, Ronald Pringle. Good morning, counsel. I'd like to first start by explaining why I had requested that the court listen to the audio tape made by Attorney Unke of his conversation with Mary Louise Pringle. The trial court did, and I really would like, and I was going to play it to have you all sit here and essentially force you to listen to this tape.
Well, we'll listen to it as part of the record when we, after the oral argument, but you only got 20 minutes and we didn't want you to use it all up on a recording that we're going to listen to anyway.
And I appreciate that. I just wanted you to hear from Mary, in essentially her own words, why she was doing what she did, whether she had the capacity to do what she did. And it's clear on both counts, she knew what she was trying to accomplish, and she wanted to accomplish what she did accomplish. The trial court found that she spoke in a clear, certain voice.
But, what if she was doing it because she had been influenced unduly?
That's circular reasoning. You got to look at the facts. You have to look at what influences were brought upon her.
Exactly. And what if she was acting because Ron had unduly influenced her?
Then, if she was deprived of her free will, which is the test laid out by this court, then there's undue influence. But there's been no evidence at all to suggest that Ron Pringle deprived her of free will. The trial court was astonished that the interested parties would not come and visit. They would not try to repair their relationship with Mary Louise Pringle. Judy testified that she called Mary Louise Pringle, talked to her about the issue with the sewer cap, said what she wanted to say, and hung up on her. There's no testimony that Mary Louise Pringle ever contacted Judy or that Judy ever contacted Mary Louise Pringle until she was in the nursing home, and this was in 2005. Then they came together, and the trial court was pleased at that because determined because of her incompetence, she was able to forgive and forget, and the three could be reunified. The trial court suspected Mr. Pringle of exercising undue influence. Attorney Unke suspected Mr. Pringle of exercising undue influence. That is why Attorney Unke created the tape. He was concerned of that, or about that. The tape shows clearly why she was creating the farmland deed. Ron was the one who was managing the farm and had been managing the farm for 13 years prior to that point in time. She thought highly of Ron. She affectionately referred to him as her Robin Hood. He would contact her daily. He cared about her. He loved her. That's why he contacted her every day. And Ron Pringle also testified that Mary contacted him more than she contacted. Then he contacted her. Many of the contacts left telephone messages back and forth. The phone was essentially Mary's lifeline. She had extended conversations with Ron, with Ron's children, and as far as I know, with some of Judy's children. Because she helped Mr. Maxwell with college education. She helped Ronnie Pringle with college education. She was a giving person. But the court also found that she could hold a grudge. The court also found that if approached, she could reconcile. Testimony was that there was a reconciliation between Judy and Mary when they had a dispute in 1999. Neither Judy or Tom tried to reconcile or reestablish their relationship with their mother from 2000, summer 2000, until 2005. The other, in the tape, the other reason why Mary Louise Pringle stated she wanted the farm to go to Ronald Pringle, well, she created the joint tenancy, and she was assuming that she would not survive Mr. Ron Pringle, was that she was concerned about family heritage. She wanted to make sure that the farm wasn't sold, and she knew or believed that Ron would not sell the farm. Ron won't sell the farm. He's been in our office, spoke to my partner about creating a trust, irrevocable trust, to make sure that that farm stays in the Pringle family. It's important to him. It's important to Judy. I'm sorry, it's important to Mary Louise Pringle that that farm stay in the family. She was concerned that the other two children would sell the farm and get the money. The other thing with undue influence is we have to look at the close proximity of the deeds, the farmland deed, and her last will and testament. Counsel's mistaken on the timeline. The warranty deed on the farmland was executed first, then her last will was executed, and there were only a couple days between them. The will was executed September 26, 2000. The farmland deed was executed 9/19/2000. That's found at Trial Exhibit 9, RP 204, as on the farmland deed. There's no allegation that that Ronald Pringle exercised undue influence in creating the will. Just the farmland deed, and the two are real close in time. Ron Pringle was present for neither the will execution or the signing of the quitclaim deed. I'm sorry, warranty deed. He was in Bridgewater. She was in Hill City. She brought her own witnesses, which were the Pines, and she arranged for her own notary, which was Mr. Neil Halsworth. The notary testified that he had no question about Mary Louise Pringle's competency. The notary also testified that he felt that she was free of any undue influence. Attorney Unke testified the same. Attorney Unke testified that she was free of any undue influence. He stated four reasons why she created the joint tenancy in the farmland deed, which I've essentially stated. Ron was managing the farm. She loved Ron. She believed that Ron would continue to manage the farm. She thought the others would sell it. I would also briefly like to address what I believe are misstatements of the record concerning activities that Ronald allegedly took. Transferring vehicles of titles. The appellant's brief references that Ronald used the power of attorney to transfer titles. He did not. Mary signed those titles. Mary had to encourage Ron. Ron didn't want to transfer the vehicles to him. He thought that the vehicles were a liability, and you testified to such. In the appellant's brief, they also state that Ron wrote checks to reimburse himself for traveling expenses. Again, it was Mary Louise Pringle who wrote the checks, and she did reimburse him for traveling expenses, as she would routinely do when people helped her. She would show her appreciation by giving them gas money. The evidence shows that she did the same with Judy, that she gave Judy a check of $3,000 and a check of $5,000. She would help lend a helping hand, is the way Mary referred to it, when people helped her.
What reasons did she give for conveying the Hill City property to Ron and Ron's son?
That happened later. That happened September 27, 2002. The testimony from Ron was that she wanted to create, she also wanted to keep that in the family, that she didn't necessarily want that. So there's a testimony of deposition of Judy that she wanted to get that property. There wasn't nearly as much testimony about the Hill City property and why that was transferred. The focus of this case has been on the farmland deed, not on the last will, just the farmland deed.
But there was no testimony by her as to why she did that?
No, because the tape-recorded statement was made prior to the execution of the farmland deed and the last will. Attorney Unke chose to not record any other conversations with her. He prepared the Hill City property deed. And Attorney Unke did testify in deposition that he had other contacts with Mary Louise Pringle other than that one that conversation he had with her tape. And she stated other reasons why she was doing what she was doing with the farmland deed. I don't believe he went as far as explaining why she did the Hill, transferred the Hill property in joint tenancy. Ronald testified that they were creating a monument on the property to bury her ashes, and that was presumably part of her intent, but that was Ron's testimony.
And her husband was already buried on that Hill City property, right, the ashes? So.
No, the husband was buried in Bridgewater Cemetery. Charles Pringle, one of the other sons who was omitted from her even prior will, and I think that was 1988 or something, a long time ago, was involved in litigation. He sued Ron Pringle to have the father's ashes moved out of the Bridgewater Cemetery. And Judge Tice, who had the conservator guardianship file, directed that the ashes were to be put in the Black Hill Cemetery, and that's what was done. So, no, I don't believe there's any testimony that the ashes went to the Hill City property. His ashes went to the Hill City property. And I would like to go through the four elements of undue influence. The first is susceptibility to undue influence. Judy Pringle testified that she thought Mary Louise Pringle was not very susceptible to undue influence. Judy testified to that fact. Ron certainly testified to that fact. All of the people who were around Mary Louise Pringle at the time that she created the joint tenancy in the farmland, at the time she created her last will, thought she was strong-willed, stubborn, full-headed, jealous. Those are the words that are almost uniformly used to describe Mary Louise Pringle. She knew what she wanted to do. No one was going to change her mind. The trial court made that determination, as the trial court gets to do. That's the trial court's job, is to determine credibility of witnesses, weigh the evidence, and make a determination. I don't believe the appellants can argue that the trial court committed reversible error in deciding not to give credence to the testimony of Adam A. Klein. Trial court's entitled to discount testimony of any witness the trial court wants to based on perceived bias. What the trial court focused on was the three children. The trial court focused on Attorney Unke, what he had to say, what Neil Hallsworth had to say, who was also obviously a disinterested party. He was a bank, her banker, basically, bank president of the First Western Bank, Hill City Branch. Next element, opportunity to exercise undue influence. We readily admit that there's a confidential relationship between, there was between Ron Pringle and Mary Louise Pringle. We also readily admit he had the opportunity to unduly influence her if he was so inclined. If we're looking at a chalkboard, for the box on susceptibility to undue influence would be checked no, the box on opportunity would be checked yes. Then the third element, disposition to exert undue influence for an improper person. At purpose. As I stated, the judge suspected Ronald Pringle because of the farmland went to him. The judge listened to all of the evidence. He was convinced and he found that Ronald Pringle did nothing to exert undue influence upon Mary Louise Pringle. He was looking for some evidence that she threatened, that Ronald threatened the children to stay away from mother. If you don't stay away from mother, I'm going to hurt you. No such testimony was elicited at trial from any of the witnesses. Not just the children, but any other witness. No one testified that Ron took any overt action, made any threat to cut off the children's relationship with their mother. They surmised and believed that he did something to do that. But nothing beyond a presumption, nothing beyond a belief. And that's what the trial court said, is I can't make something out of whole cloth.
Tom testified that I believe Ron wanted the farmland in the worst way, and he would do whatever it took to acquire that farmland and any other property that Mom owned free and clear without paying a dime for it. Do you accept that testimony?
Well, I accept that he made the statement. I certainly don't accept the truth and veracity of it, that Ron would do anything, because there's no evidence that he did anything.
Do you, aside from the fact of whether or not he did anything, do you accept the fact that he had the disposition to do that? In other words, was he disposed to, even if he didn't do it?
Well, he did want to farm. He asked them about his ability to purchase the farm under a contract for deed. And Tom Sr.'s response was, don't worry, it's taken care of. His son Ronnie, in discussing family heritage, expressed a desire to have the farm remain in the Pringle family.
What I'm getting at is, do you acknowledge that he had the disposition? Because we have opportunity. If we have disposition, we obviously have the result that favors it. So the only thing left would be susceptibility.
He didn't have the disposition. He had the desire to continue farming. But he didn't take any action to affect the result. It was clear and simple. It was estate planning. She wanted, as the court mentioned, many children have inherited farms in the state of South Dakota. This is what Mary wanted. She wanted Ronald Pringle to inherit the farm. She wanted him to inherit the farm because he was going to farm it, he was going to keep it in the family, and she was concerned that the other was going to sell it. It's a matter of estate planning. It's not a matter of undue influence. And this court would make many farmers, ranchers, very nervous if the court rules because of a result, you can't inherit. Just because of the fact that the farmland went to one person and not to all of the children, that constitutes undue influence. And that's basically, and that the naked assertion is where we're at with this case, because there is no evidence that Ron took any abort actions to effectuate his desire to continue to farm upon his mother to deprive her of her free will.
But didn't he almost, I mean, did he end up with everything of value?
He ended up...
bank accounts that they were distributed, or did he and no. his son ended up, or did he and his son end up with everything, practically everything of value?
No. No, there's the house in, big house in Bridgewater that is still part of the probate estate. There was CDs. Some of the CDs have been spent on her care, but I believe there's still some CD monies available. And I could be wrong in that. Well,
somebody mentioned the 1.2 whatever million. How much value is left in the estate after these deeds were given to Ron and his son?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I can't answer that with any specificity. There's the big house in Bridgewater. There's, I believe there's CD monies left, her personal property, some antiques, but not much. Most of it is junk we collect.
Is the house in Bridgewater being lived in?
As far as I know, it's not. As far as I know, it's vacant. And then finally, I would like to address...
All right, time's up.
Okay, then I guess I won't let it address.
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Picker. 10 minutes.
Thank you. I want to touch on Justice Konecamp's last question. If you consider the amount and the value of a property compared to what's left, it's not even close. It's maybe at the most a couple $100,000, and that's being, I think, generous compared to $1.2, $1.3 million worth of property. And I think that addresses that. I want to focus on the susceptibility element of the undue influence, because technically that is the only one that the court really ruled on, and I think it was he was clearly erroneous in finding that Mary was not susceptible to undue influence.
But before you get there, did you prove that he had the disposition to exercise undue influence?
I'm glad you brought that up, Justice Sabers. If you look at the case of the state of Bowersch, a disposition to unduly influence for an improper purpose is evident from persistent efforts to gain control and possession of testator's property. Ronald initiated a conversation with Unke that led to him ultimately receiving this land in joint tenancy. You also look at the testimony of Joel Pine. Joel Pine asked Ronald, why are you letting your mother live in squalor like this? Well, I can't do anything to move her out of there because she'll disown me. She'll take me out of the will. She'll disinherit. And that's a disposition right there, showing that he was unwilling to remove her from deplorable conditions in case it might affect his inheritance or his ability to take this land. Joel Pine also testified that when Mary and Thomas sold a cabin located in Renal Gulch, Ronald was angry. He felt he should have got that. He said, I'm next in line to inherit this. This shows his disposition. Davies versus Toms, again, provides guidance. When a beneficiary obtains substantially all the property owned by the grantor, this circumstance alone can prove a disposition to exert undue influence. So I think that a disposition to exert undue influence is not a question. And I think it was clearly established by the testimony that was given at the trial. And as you mentioned, the result itself, this shows that there was a result clearly indicating that undue influence was exercised in this matter. Ronald ended up with the majority of all the estate, all the meaningful property, all the valuable property. These deeds demonstrate an unnatural disposition of her property under the will. The will divided up the property, all her estate, three ways. Well, now he's removed everything of value from the will via this joint tenancy deed. Etta May testified, Mary always told me the property was to be divided between my children. There's also other authority. Courts will find that a deed is the product of undue influences if there is a change in post-death distribution plans, which gives the influencer an advantage over those who shared in prior plans. And that's from Will Contest Undue Influence, Section 7.7. That's on our brief as well. That's further authority. But going back to the susceptibility, Joel Pine, longtime friend and neighbor of Mary and Thomas. Again, nothing to gain in this. He unequivocally testified that it was his opinion that Mary relied extensively on Ronald. She relied on Ronald for everything. She could not make a decision without checking with Ronald. Gloria Pine testified to the same. Adam I. Kleiman testified to the same. Ron Johnson also testified that Ronald affected his relationship with Mary. Told him not to contact her anymore. Adam May testified that it was Ronald that led to the dissolution of all of Mary's friendships and relationships. It was her testimony that Ronald was a source of it. So I think that's very important to show that the susceptibility is clearly erroneous for the judge to fail to find that the first element of undue influence was met. That means susceptibility. As we know, the second prong has been conceded. I think the third prong, the evidence and the testimony, speaks towards a disposition to exert undue influence, and I provided authority that I feel shows that the result was clearly the effect of undue influence. And that's really, unless the court had any questions as to the elements, so I want to touch on that. I have not addressed breach of fiduciary duty. He brought that up briefly in his response. When you have a power of attorney, you have a fiduciary duty to place the best interests of the person ahead of anyone else's, ahead of your own. And allowing Mary to live as she did, that in of itself is a breach of that fiduciary duty. The power of attorney did not authorize any acts of self-dealing.
But that's all after the fact, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor. I would concede that considerations have yet to be made as far as some of the other breaches based on, I believe it was Miss Rebecca Porter has to make some determinations as far as certain gifts and checks and what have you. But I do feel that the trial court never ruled on that issue, whether or not there was a breach of fiduciary duty. I also think it's important, I want to backtrack a bit. There's been a lot of discussion about the strong will testimony. We don't dispute that Mary had a very strong will. She could carry a grudge. But it was error for the court to place reliance on this testimony about the strong will. There's case law cited by this court saying that strong will of the decedent does not make that person any less susceptible, someone upon which they rely. I think that's very important for the court to consider when it's making its determination in this matter on that issue. Bullheadedness, strong will, that's something that this court has determined does not need to be, does not affect your susceptibility.
Listen to the tape. Is there any evidence whatsoever in the tape, in your opinion, that would lead us to think that whatever she's saying, which your opponent is very impressed with, that she's being put upon or that a gun is being held to her head to say that?
I think the fact that she knew, she had her mind made up, and she was very adamant. She was very certain of what she wanted to do. And I feel as though that clearly shows a result of undue influence. You're being conditioned.
So you're conceding she had testamentary capacity.
I think that's a fair concession to make. Especially at that time in the year 2000.
What do you have to show or demonstrate that Ron caused her to have her mind made up?
Well, I think the result itself, Your Honor. I think if you look at the fact that she had a pre-existing will that divided up the property three ways between the three children, and then this changed that out of the blue. This was her estate plan for years. You look at her prior wills, pretty much the same. Divide the property up between Tom, Chuck, and Judy. Or, I'm sorry, Tom, Judy, and Ronald. And now all of a sudden, we get the power of attorney, and then we get this million-dollar farmland being placed in a joint tenancy with no real consideration. It's divesting her estate. It's reducing it from what was very substantial to very little. And I think that that has relevance. Back to your question regarding the testamentary capacity. I think it's important, and there's case law on this, and I'll see if I can locate it before my time is up, and I doubt that's possible, but there is case law that states that the influence needed to satisfy a finding of undue influence. It's different than what's needed to show testamentary capacity. I don't think I did a good job of explaining that, but I don't question her testamentary capacity at that time. I think it comes into question in 2002, and I think that the evidence will show that. Testamentary capacity is not the issue here. It's undue influence. And the four elements of undue influence, I think, are clearly established. Whether or not she had testamentary capacity, you don't need a whole lot for testamentary capacity. And I think she, at that time she had it, but I also feel that it's clear that she was being unduly influenced. If you look at all the evidence that was presented to the trial court, and I think he was clearly erroneous in ignoring a substantial portion of the testimony from disinterested witnesses. And I think that that's important for this court to consider in making its determination.
Ignoring or discounting?
Well, ignoring. I think that he ignored it. And he states what he relied upon in his oral ruling. And so I don't think it was simply discounted. He does discount the testimony of Adam A. Kleiman, but he does not discount the testimony of Deputy Smith, Gloria Pine, Joel Pine, Ron Johnson, Michelle. Just ignored it and doesn't make any reference to it. He's looking for proof. Those individuals all had proof. They all had testimony that was not driven by pecuniary gain or anything of that nature. They were subpoenaed, they testified, they all stated Mary relied on Ron for everything. And she was susceptible to what he wanted. What Ron wanted, Ron got, is what Adam A. said. I see that my time is almost up unless the court has any other questions for me.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
We will be in recess for 10 minutes.